How do we help clients who can't seem to move the needle toward happiness? Often, we can be inclined to think it's a motivational issue. But according to Dr. Michael Yapko, we'd be wrong. Here, Michael looks at the critical missing element that keeps many clients stuck in their resistance.
Resistance is in the eye of the beholder. But I think speaking to the fact that people sometimes do want to keep things the same, and they're not jumping on board with doing things differently or being willing to experiment. I really like the framing that we've previously talked about, the notion of rigidity as opposed to resistance. But I think that the view that resistance is a communication from the client, that's as valid as any other communication in helping describe where the boundaries are of this client's experience, what they're willing to allow themselves, what they're not willing to allow themselves to do. And I think that we've had this polarity that's existed in the field since the times of Freud that has essentially defined people's problems in either motivational terms or in skill-based terms. And the idea that resistance is a motivational issue, that people don't want to change or that people aren't motivated to change, has led to all kinds of formulations like unconscious fear of success and unconscious fear of failure and secondary gains that reinforce the person for staying the same. And to me, those aren't particularly useful things. What I find in my work is that it's really not so much about the motivation, that I think people typically have the motivation. They're not happy. They want things to change. But motivation alone isn't enough. No amount of motivation is going to help you watch the sunset if you want to see the sunset and you face east. No amount of motivation is going to compensate for a lack of ability. So when I'm interviewing people, I'm really interested in their level of skill. Do they even know what the next step is if they were going to do something? And very often, they don't know what the next step is, or they don't like what the next step is. But more often, they don't even know what it is. So it isn't that they're resistant. It's that they're not really sure what to do next. So that's one part of it. I mean, I can go on, but the next piece that I would talk about is the role of expectancy in motivational issues and quote-unquote resistance. You know, in clinical terms, one of the things that we work with is a person's attributional style, a person's way of explaining life events that happen. And there are different characteristics of attributions, but one of those characteristics is whether the attribution is a stable or unstable one, speaking to whether the person views their circumstances that are adverse as either transient or temporary or permanent. But when you have someone who has negative expectations, why bother? And it's why, for me particularly, having specialized in treating depression for these last 40 years, I'm dealing with people who on the surface seem to be so unmotivated, but they have an attitude of why bother? Why bother to go for help? Nobody's ever going to be able to help me. Why bother to do the homework that my therapist gives me? It's never going to make a difference. And that may seem like a motivational issue, but it's actually a cognitive perspective, a viewpoint, a belief system that says effort isn't going to pay off. And that can easily look like resistance to people. So there are a lot of different ways of thinking about resistance, but I guess by way of summary, I'd say I'm less inclined to view it as a personal phenomenon and view it more as an interpersonal phenomenon. Can I create, as a therapist, a context where this person is willing to stretch the boundaries of who they are and what they do?
So let's go back to the person, the depressed person that you were talking about, whose belief might be effort isn't going to pay off. I just want to get a little clearer picture on how you conceptualize that. Do you see that person as lacking skill?
I think so. That when the person doesn't have the ability to establish a realistic expectation. If the person doesn't have the ability to establish a sequence for how to produce what they want. So in other words, what goes hand in hand with depression is a phenomenon of thinking called a global cognitive style or overgeneral thinking. So the person will establish goals like, I just want to be happy, but they don't really have any sense for how to produce that. There isn't any sequence to follow. So when it seems so unattainable to them because they don't know what the steps are to produce it, they become resistant to anything that suggests that there's something they could actually do to help themselves. And when you couple that with the helplessness that depressed people often feel, it just seems so big, so overwhelming, so confusing that they just retreat into what they know, even though it's miserable. And so it becomes one of the therapist's tasks. How can I break this into something doable? Someone wise once said that a goal without steps is merely a wish. And I definitely believe that. And the ability to help people develop realistic sequences is a lot of what goes on in therapy for me. And you know, the evidence is that when you provide people with a doable sequence, when you provide a series of steps that they can actually follow that fall within the realm of what their capabilities are, as I keep on expanding their range of capabilities, people get better.
As Michael said, motivation can't always compensate for a lack of ability. It's like that quote, it's not enough to stir up the steps, we have to step up the stairs. Sometimes our clients just need to know exactly how to take that first step. For some additional insights into this, let's visit now with Dr. Ron Siegel and Bill O'Hanlon.
It's interesting that if we think that, well, secretly or unconsciously, I don't want to change, then there's a kind of moral overlay to that or a kind of character criticism that's embedded in that. But if it's simply, oh, I simply never learned how to feel these feelings, or I never developed the skill to be able to assert myself in a given situation, then it becomes like, well, I didn't take the algebra course, so let's do the algebra course. So it makes these things much less about me, much less tied into our self-esteem issues, and really allows us to have the flexibility to approach it. So I actually do this a lot in reframing things, because I realize a lot of my work involves trying to help people not to feel threatened on a self-esteem level by what we're talking about, so that they can relax defenses and open up to something. And I think particularly about one fellow who I worked with for a while, who managed his adolescence with a lot of drugs and alcohol. He grew up in a somewhat abusive background with not a lot of supports, not a lot of support for feeling feelings. So he basically, rather than acknowledge any sadness, rather than acknowledge any fear, he drank a lot and did a lot of drugs. And now as an adult, he realized that he had very little capacity to feel feeling. As soon as a little bit of fear came up, he was driven to substances. A little bit of anger came up, driven to substances. A little bit of sadness, driven to substances. And of course, he was filled with the normal self-recrimination that happens to somebody who has a, you know, a substance abuse problem. By reframing it as, look, he never developed the skill to be able to feel sadness. Never developed the skill to be able to feel anger and not act on it. Never developed the skill to be able to be with fear, and that he could actually develop these skills. It kind of took it out of the moral realm, took it out of all of the self-recrimination, and he was able to start working on building those skills and actually started using mindfulness practices, which are, you know, one pathway toward building those kinds of affect tolerance skills in order to do it. So I think this reframe that really comes out of behavioral traditions can be enormously useful to us.
I had a client who was pretty troubled, and we were making progress in therapy, but every once in a while, this weird thing would happen. And I didn't know what it was about. I just knew, you know, something had triggered her troubledness. And in the middle of a therapy session, she would just curl up into a ball, kind of in a fetal position, and just kind of withdraw. And for 10, 15, there was not, I couldn't get to her. I couldn't get any response from her. And then she gradually come out of it. And this happened, not every session, but a fair amount. And after a while, I discovered a pattern. You know, we talked about it and she didn't know what was going on. She just knew that she just freaked out every once in a while and couldn't control it. So I noticed a pattern that about 5 minutes after I told a story, which I do a lot in therapy, I tell lots of stories, that would happen. And she, once I identified it, she said, yes. What I realized is that when you tell stories, they're almost always somebody who has trouble and then they resolve it. And as soon as you tell that story, I think I'm not a good enough client because I may not resolve my troubles. And that was such a great insight to me into her basic psychology and the pressure she put on herself. It became the very essence of the therapy we did. So what looked like resistance was really a great deal of valid information. And it took me a little while to get to her, and she didn't know it consciously. But once we discovered that, it was the key to the therapy.
As we heard, a lack of skills can hobble our client's ability to get better. In the next module, we'll look at different ways to work with willful clients. I'll see you there.